Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, May 18th, 2015, and I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. And I am now opening a public hearing on House Bill 5041 related to the Treasurer of the State, Mr. Borden.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair, members of the Subcommittee. Before you is the State Treasurer for their Phase 2 presentation on their budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wheeler, Mr. Who else is coming up with you? Mr. Bond or Mr. Hara, are you coming up now or anybody? Who's coming up?
We're going to have a variety.
Okay. Well, then everybody come up in time and introduce yourselves, and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the State Treasurer. Today is our Phase 2 budget hearing, and Laura, I think you're going to have to work this, the clicky.
Oh, sure. Got it.
Thank you. So our presentation overview today, obviously we're going to discuss the POPs, the policy option packages, policy measures in support of the POPs, technical adjustments, a brief discussion of the reduction options, and throughout you obviously exercise your right to ask any questions you would like. First up is POP 103, the coordination of the higher education debt. With me is Laura Lockwood McCall from the State Treasury, who will walk us through it.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Laura Lockwood McCall, State Treasurer's Office. We put this POP 103 in because we had responsibilities this past 2 years to manage the university bond administration. When Senate Bill 270 was passed in 2013, it was a good bill. It started the process of the dissolution of the OUS system. But one of the things we didn't address at that time was who would be in charge of their debt financing. In October of last year, we went to the emergency board and received funding for $550,000 to cover the cost of both bond counsel and financial advisor for a one-year period, which we've been utilizing those services, and we've done a refunding that saved several million dollars for both the general fund and the universities, and we are in the process of doing a new money borrowing in June. This POP was put in as a two-year expenditure limitation for 2 years worth of those services if we didn't reach some conclusion as to who would be in charge of university bond administration. We have submitted HB 3199 to address that issue. In that, we have DAS as the bond issuing entity who would take over the services for bond counsel and financial advisor from an expenditure limitation position. Since that bill hasn't been adopted yet by the legislature, we still need to leave it alive here. And so depending on the outcome of HB 3199, if indeed bond administration does move to DAS in the future, then Treasury won't need this in their budget.
Ms. Lockwood McCall, you probably have had conversations with us. I guess I'm a little puzzled, and I know we've had some conversations, but I kind of like to get it on the record. We made the decision to let OUS go off sort of on its own with the understanding that the general fund obligations were going to be more targeted toward actually the education piece. And yet here we are having to spend $1 million this biennium to, whether it's the treasurer's office or DAS, somebody's going to have to use that $1 million. Can you talk a little bit about conversations that you all have had with OUS about why the state's paying for this and not OUS itself, since they're getting the proceeds from the bonds?
Through the chair. Indirectly, they're paying for bond administration services because we recapture those costs either through issuance at the time we sell bonds, and for the 11F bonds that have been authorized by the legislature, they're GO bonds. So ultimately, at the end of the day, the universities repay that portion through debt service payments. It is true that when we sell GO bonds under 11G of the Constitution, those are general fund debt service. So at the end of the day, if the legislature chooses to authorize 11G and 11F borrowing through the bond bill, which we did during the 13-15 legislative session, then this is just the implementation of the legislative authority to sell 11F and 11G bonds. So if you think about it, the legislature continues to authorize new capital construction projects at schools. And so this, again, we recapture the costs through those processes. Now, to the extent the general fund is paying the 11G debt, then the general fund has a new cost. But it's simply the cost of each transaction.
Thank you. Senator Whitson?
Thank you. I thought I understood this, but if the
university system is going to bear the costs, and why are you using $1.1 million of general fund or your other other funds? And maybe you could help us understand how that's not a double payment.
Through the chair, Senator Whitsitt, these are expenditure limitations to enter into contracts to conduct the legislative focus, which is to sell bonds. So they aren't being double counted. It's just that we aren't allowed to enter into contracts without an expenditure limitation. So we need this budget money, but in essence, it clears itself out through other
an expenditure funds. Limitation. Okay,
yes, sir.
I understand it. And the other thing, I was looking at House Bill 3199, which is, I believe, up for a hearing tomorrow or their work session. There is absolutely nothing on OLIS regarding that bill. Could you help us understand what might happen there?
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Whitsitt, that was a placeholder bill that Treasury introduced early along when we noticed that we needed to fix this in the law. There's a Dash 1 amendment that's been underway that we've been working on with the universities, with our bond council, their bond council. The Dash 1 amendments came out of Ledge Council on Friday. There's some additional amendments that I think the universities are going to want to pursue from that bill. And we're hoping that we'll get those comments this week. The hearing will be delayed a week, and that we'll be in a position on May 27th, which is the following Wednesday, to have a work session on that bill. Now, the structure of what that bill says, what we're agreeing on, is that DAS will work with Treasury as the bond administration coordination agency in terms of getting bonds sold. The program agency that will both manage debt service payments from the universities as well as disperse bond proceeds would be the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, because it's under this jurisdiction as an education entity. Many of the other details have to do with how we treat 11F and 11G bonds. In the past, we would hand proceeds over to the universities. They were part of state government. They're now a separate legal entities from state government, and we've been advised by Department of Justice that we need to have different kinds of legal arrangements. So for the 11G bonds, which is a 50% match that the universities make, we consider the money that we hand them, the general fund pays a debt service, to be grants. So we'll have grant contracts for future 11G to make sure that they live up to all the terms and conditions under the tax certificates that they need to do to maintain the tax exemption on the bonds. And under the 11F bonds, these are GO bonds where they're self-supporting. They're basically repaid from university payments to the state. And those will be treated as loan agreements. So we'll hand the money over again through HEC disbursement. But the debt service payments will have to be repaid to the state over time so they can maintain that self-supporting test.
And I assume Legislative Council believes that's all copacetic with the Constitution.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, we've been working carefully with the language in the Constitution to craft these agreements. We're working on a real-life bond issue as we speak, and so we're having this real-life opportunity to work through how do we sell bonds with these new legal arrangements, still meet the needs of the state in terms of protecting the state's credit rating, the state's general fund, but also the needs of the university in terms of getting their work done. And it is a bit of a compromise. They would like us to just hand over all the money, but we need to have a centralized way to track interest earnings under federal tax laws for tax rebates. So we've all had to make some compromises, and we're hoping that we can reach that consensus point later this week and get this bill to you soon.
And do you anticipate there will be any negative effect on interest rates?
Through the chair, I don't think so. I think that we've worked really hard to maintain a system that will protect the state's credit rating and therefore our interest rates.
Thank you very much.
Great. If there's no other questions on that, POP 102, the Cash Management Improvement and Renewable Program, we have Cora Parker, who's the Director of Finance, who will be coming up for that.
Thank you.
If you wouldn't mind, Cora, if you could just move it, if you could just pull up that arrow when you get to the bottom of each page.
Yes, I'll do my best.
Oh, well, it is what it is.
Let's see. Let me check. There. Okay. We will figure out the technology as we talk about a technology package. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cora Parker. I'm the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury, and I'm here today to talk to you about Package 102, the Cash Management Improvement and Renewal Program. Before I start with the information that's actually on this slide, I thought I'd give you some additional context about the Cash Management Program. We focus on services that optimize the use of cash for our agency and local government customers, with more than $210 billion flowing out of Treasury, in and out of Treasury in 2014. As my boss, the Deputy Treasurer, likes to say, money is the lubricant that keeps the gears of government moving. We act as the banking services provider for state agencies, including providing a host of banking services. That's depository, check redemption, ACH or EFT services, electronic funds transfer services, as you likely know them. And we provide those services to agencies via a number of contracts with financial services providers. Essentially, we act in a role so that state government can have a one-to-many relationship instead of a many-to-many relationship. And that drives efficiencies both in service delivery and in statewide pricing. We operate both the Oregon Short-Term Fund and the Local Government Investment Pool as a short-term cash investment vehicle. Agency funds are there by default, and roughly 1,000 local governments choose to participate in that fund. So now, on to the slide and on to the package. A few years ago, as we began to face the need to replace several of our critical cash management systems, we recognized the value of creating a continuous improvement approach to doing so instead of simply waiting for end-of-life failure or near failure and then acting. The resulting cash management improvement program is aimed at supporting the ongoing services of our customers by balancing innovation opportunities against both risk awareness and resource capacity at OST and, frankly, at agencies as well. And then also to adapting our services to meet changing stakeholder needs. Package 102 was a $1 placeholder both at agency request and at the governor's recommended budget phase. The replacement budget is just under $4.5 million. That's what we'll be talking to you about today. That actually includes really three sort of sections of this policy package, and we'll go into more detail about that on the following slides. All right, now the test.
Sorry, Senator Whitsitt.
I think you, on your last bullet point, it says resulting in a series of ongoing projects. Is this $4.5 million request this time, is this going to be, do you anticipate having further requests like this in the future?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, so the request for two of the projects that we'll talk about today really will put those to rest, if you will, sort of finality for these projects as it relates to, you know, the foreseeable future. Obviously, it won't be technology that will last forever, but this really is the final request as it relates to implementation of those projects. The third category that we'll get to, the funds are really just related to kicking off and initiating the project. Okay. And I think the slides that I have coming forward will actually delve into that separation for you. So there are many challenges with the applications that currently support our cash management systems. System failures and lack of vendor support. As an example, some of the components for one of our tools, our voice response system, sits on a server that isn't upgradable because the application itself can't be moved to a new server. That presents, as you might imagine, a number of problems. In addition, our business processes are then designed around those legacy systems that are outdated, and our ability to adapt to industry trends and implement desired services becomes impacted by that. The volume of automated financial transactions, the very type of transactions that these systems support, is growing, which adds further stress and further risk. The coding languages that many of the system components are built in is outdated and increasingly difficult to purchase or recruit for, very expensive if we can even find the assistance at all. We're dealing with retirements, both a number of people who are eligible and, as we've begun to see in the preceding months leading up to this presentation, we're experiencing actual retirements, not just the possibility of those retirements. Most recently, our database administrator retired, and there are at least three other members of our application staff who are actually eligible to do so today. At the same time, customer service expectations continue to increase. Customers of our state agencies want to see the same kind of banking services provided via state government as they see being offered from their banks and financial institutions, which means that our agency partners come to us wanting those same kind of services as well. That's both a blessing and a curse from an operational and management perspective, as you might imagine. And while not specifically called out in a bullet on this page, underlying many of these issues are the information security challenges presented by the current systems and processes that go along with them. So what are the systems? On the slide in front of you, you see a simplified diagram of our cash management systems infrastructure. As you can see from the color-coded diagram, we have a mix of both purchased and internally developed systems. Many of these were put in place in the late 90s, coming up on Y2K. They're highly integrated with transactions flowing between the systems. They handle very time-sensitive financial transactions and have high security requirements. That is, the data that flows through them has very high security requirements. Phoenix, which is in the center box, was a purchase system which serves as the repository for managing our DDA, or demand deposit accounts, as well as our general ledger. The systems on the outside directly support our banking services, particularly those for ACH or local government investment pool transactions. And again, we'll discuss those more in a minute. The operations application, which is the big circle around the Phoenix system, is a custom application that plays a key role and kind of a middleware solution that talks between the other systems. And the operations application, again, that key middleware role, is one of those applications built in that outdated Power Builder language that I referenced earlier.
Thank
you. Going back to that last slide, can you, I don't expect you to have this on the top of your head by any means, but can you get us the figures on how much the State Treasury is paying DAS for that access to their server for this and other different projects that you have going? And what your anticipation is once you have these replaced, if there's going to be significant savings or it's going to be more or less or whatever. And that question really comes from my position on the IT committee. It's fascinating that no one really seems to be looking forward as to what the ongoing cost and maintenance of these programs will be.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I can follow up with more depth, but I can tell you we're not a data center customer, so these are servers that are resident at Treasury primarily. That's not to say that there aren't some costs that we share via DAS. Obviously, we are a state agency, and there are some connections there, but we look very different than some of our other.
Your data server is within your agency?
Yes, entirely so.
Okay, thank you.
If I could just then request, if you're going to be providing us with more information, I think Senator Whitsitt brings up an important point about long-term maintenance. That being said, my guess is that there are inherent costs involved in maintaining any obsolete or near-obsolete system, so it would be important for us to have some sense. It's hard to predict what the costs would be going forward if we were not to do this, or if you were to invest in a solution that was sort of a one-time solution as opposed to a contracted solution, for which would include upgrades and ongoing maintenance. But I think we need to have some understanding about the cost structures related to all of those as we think about this. Is that a fair statement?
If I could follow up just a little bit. You know what I would like, in a perfect world, we would have an enterprise budget for each of these. So what is your capital cost? What is your ongoing maintenance and operational cost? What is your, are you going to have a cost savings in labor? And, of course, in this particular thing, you have a security issue that would be very difficult, I suppose, to put a price on until, you only know what the price is when it crashes. But that type of presentation would be very useful to us from the standpoint of this needs to be done because, and it's going to save this much money, or it's going to, and not only the money that would save for the Treasury, but also for the money it would save for your customers. I'm assuming that speeding things up is going to help your customers a lot as well.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think you'll find that the issues you just raised are actually many of the same issues that we faced and and worked through as we developed our business cases for both projects. As Senator Whitsitt mentioned, many of them are actually very difficult to quantify because you are talking about sort of making an assumption about what it would cost to bring something in line with a certain level of security compliance or a certain level of industry adaptability, if you will, when you talk about the ongoing banking industry and how things evolve. We certainly wrestled with that issue in our business cases, and hopefully how we developed that has been amenable to Mr. Borden and his peer analysts within the Legislative Fiscal Office. But those issues were definitely a major component of what we looked at as we talked about how to replace this, and frankly, one of the reasons that we selected the approach that we did, which we'll talk about in the coming slides here. So very, very important issues.
Thank you.
So again, in 2013-15, we had a policy package in front of you. It was also package 102, just so we could confuse the issue as much as possible. it contained funds for both the business process mapping project that we had initiated with one-time savings and a single limited duration position during the 2011-13 biennium. And it provided permanent staffing to recognize the ongoing continuous renewal cycle and approach that we were taking with these projects. Staffing resources in the policy package included those dedicated to ongoing project management and business analysis efforts, but also provided resources to bolster critical daily operations so that we could adequately use subject matter experts as we evaluated and replaced business and technology systems and processes. Treasury committed to using industry best practices and standards through all phases of the renewal program, and notably the resources in the legislatively approved package allowed for development of the business cases that I just spoke about for both the ACH and LGIP business systems renewal projects, and those business cases were finalized in August of 2014.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, Ms. Parker, any outside folks talking to you about the building of your business case? Any, you said you use industry best practices. Do you rely on any industry experts to advise you in this regard?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, yes. We have a QA/QC contractor on board both for the business case development process and for implementation of the projects. And we also have a variety of consulting experts, if you will, at the sort of right point in the project to let, as we look at individual policy or other issues that might come up.
Other questions?
Okay. And now I'm trying to figure out how to get to the next page.
I think you are.
That's where I'm at, I think.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, great. Then I'll stop.
Yeah, the down arrow is not working, so.
Yeah, it's not.
Okay, so policy one, package 102 in the current biennium, it really, as I mentioned, has three individual projects that are governed under that broader continuous renewal program. The ACH, that's the systems and processes that are in light green on this screen. The local government investment pool, primarily those systems that are in blue. And then the core banking project, which is the systems and processes in gray. Again, the policy package at GRB was a placeholder. And in fact, as we've moved throughout this legislative session, we've been very much in final definition stages for purposes of defining the actual dollar ask to Ways and Means. With that in mind, each of the projects is actually in a slightly different place. The ACH and LGIP projects had the highest priority, and thus are the farthest along. The core banking systems business renewal project will actually just be formally initiated in the 2015-17 biennium. So it's behind where the others are.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
Behind by design, behind,
yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, yes. So the business case for our ACH renewal project was completed in August 2014. It recommends the transform alternative That's moving from receiving, processing, and distributing critical ACH data within our own systems. And again, that's all personally identifiable information. And instead, skipping that middleman role by moving that functionality directly to our banking partner that already plays a critical role. By law and by industry regulation, that treasury management services provider, that banking partner of ours, already has to play that role as our originating depository financial institution.
Senator Johnson.
Could you define banking partner?
So it's our treasury management services provider. We act as a bank for state government, but we aren't truly a bank. We have to actually have a bank underneath of us. We have a relationship with U.S. Bank, who is that provider, and they actually are the bank that banks treasury, if you will.
Thank you. How often is that contract refreshed? And is it a competitive contract? How did that relationship come to be?
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, it's been a very long-standing relationship. Most recently, we re-signed a redocumented version of the contract, the base contract, in, I believe, December of 2012. That's a five-year commitment. Various components of those services have been RFP'd or gone out for three bid or multiple options with respect to a more competitive service. The long-standing relationship with the provider has not been formally RFP'd in some time, and in many ways that's because of the very intertwined functionality of the current of the systems that we're actually talking about today. And interestingly, that not that I'm saying we would do this, but the move to the approach that we're taking right now actually unwinds some of those intertwinings, if you will, so that we could move more quickly and efficiently between alternative providers if we needed to.
Follow-up, Senator Johnson and Co-Chair Smith.
I guess my curiosity largely is born out of two things. One of them is I have tried this session to tease out some of these contractual relationships that exist. So many of the agencies are now contracting out their work, but I'm interested in knowing the transparency of the contract. Where are the documents available for inspection? How competitive are they? How often are they refreshed? And so it's a general curiosity about that kind of relationship. The other thing is, and I know the Treasurer is aware of this, there has been some concern raised about credit card charges in this session. And it is something that a House member is pursuing zealously.
Yes.
And the question about just how hard is your banking partner squeezed on, for lack of a more artful term, on some of these relationships and how accommodating they have been to maximize opportunities for the state. And this may not be the forum to discuss this, but it certainly gives pause when you say long-standing relationship. We look at it every once in a while, but it hasn't really been RFP'd in a long time. There are lots of financial institutions, and I'm just curious what your plans are for this relationship.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Johnson. The merchant card relationship, which is a separate contract, I believe, and I'm going to look to the deputy, was RFP'd in the early 2000s. Does that sound... and so that one has been through a competitive process more recently. We are actually in the process of gearing up for another end of contract phase. We're looking closely at what other states' pricing looks like, what their service delivery looks like, and based on some of the input from the representative that you mentioned, we're also looking at some alternative service provision approaches, if you will. So while I don't want to give the perspective that just because the big formal here's an RFP that's out on the street that can be bid, just because that doesn't happen as frequently, that we don't constantly look internally and work across a variety of our sister state governments, et cetera, to look at the pricing that we're getting. We certainly do that. It's very important.
Well, yeah.
While Mr. Bond is having, I just would say one thing for the benefit of the committee. We will be, barring yet another schedule change, having an informational hearing on this very issue next Tuesday, the day after Memorial Day. So we will be having an informational hearing on this very issue around credit cards. Mr. Bond.
Madam Chair, Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer. The one thing I might add for Cora is along this line is while the legislature has given the Treasury a significant amount of autonomy in terms of the way we negotiate services, and so we over the years have negotiated these services very strongly with U.S. Bank, and we also use 20 other banks for our various services. U.S. Bank's our largest financial services provider, but we also have a service that we periodically subscribe to called Phoenix Hect, which assesses banking service costs across the country, and we enjoy some of the very best prices for banking services of any institution in the country because we have historically negotiated very aggressively.
Thank you.
Mr. Bond, would you please provide, I mean, I'm assuming that isn't confidential or privileged information.
Actually, it is.
Oh, it is. Okay. Well, then we'll just take your word for it. Thank you. Maybe if you could just, never mind, we'll just call it good. Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I want to follow up on the questions of Senator Johnson. I think they're very important for this committee to understand. And I think I understand how difficult it'd be to untie relationships, especially longstanding ones. But is there, what information can you provide to this committee and to John and LFO that talks about here are the different relationships we have with not only U.S. Bank but our other lenders, and here are the fees that we are being charged as it relates to that?
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead and then I'll follow up.
Mr. Chair, I do think that, as Darren mentioned, some of that information, in fact, one of our KPMs actually speaks directly to the issue about what our banking costs and thus our fees to our state agencies look like over time compared to what it would otherwise look like if we were taking a different approach.
But what level of detail are we getting on that? What level of detail is LFO getting on that? Other than a KPM,
I'd have to follow up with John, and because I'm not the only one that provides John information, so I'd need to work with Scott and John to figure that out. But I think we're as transparent as we can be when asked questions. For example, with respect to the recent questions that have been coming up related to the merchant card contract, and I know we'll come back to that in a future hearing, we were very responsive and frankly provided a level of detail that I think allowed the Legislative Fiscal Office, the representative who's looking directly at the issue, to dig down into a level of detail that's beyond beyond what is otherwise available by other states, et cetera,
Madam Co-Chair.
Certainly.
So this conversation's unique because, Mr. Treasurer, you have a constitutional responsibility. We have a constitutional responsibility. And so I understand that difficulty here. I think it'd be advantageous for this committee, though, to just be able to go from 30,000 feet down to maybe 10,000 feet and get a better sense of what the relationships look like, what we're being charged, and what that means to the state of Oregon. And, you know, maybe U.S. Bank, because of the intertwined nature of these transactions, it makes sense to stick with them. Maybe it does. I don't know. But the notion that relationship has not gone under a public review in a significant period of time, and I don't know what that period of time is. That hasn't been shared with us. I think this committee needs to know that. And I understand the fine line. I genuinely do. But we have a fiduciary responsibility as well.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, first of all, I'm kicking myself that I used the intertwined example. I'm sure you've all been in that position where you use a word and you wish you hadn't.
No, let me share with the committee really quick. I manage multiple loan funds, and I have ACH payments coming from all sorts of different lenders, so I know how difficult it would be to untangle that. So that's not an absurd concept to me.
But to the extent the information with our banking partners is public, we certainly either have already shared it with John or are willing to do that. Where there's a particular line that any of our financial institutions are saying, you know, no, this falls under non-disclosable information. First of all, we just don't accept that. In fact, I just got done working with RAG's office with respect to a recent public information request related to something very similar. And we don't just say, okay, thanks, bank. You've said it's publicly, you know, non-disclosable. We work to make sure that it really does fall under those lines. And where we have a judgment call to make, we fall on the edge, as we did with the merchant card relationship, in disclosing the information. Well, so
I would never, and this will be my last comment, I would never want to cross the line of the responsibility of our state treasurer, because that is your responsibility. But I am trying to figure out where that line is and what's our fiduciary responsibility.
It's an important issue.
Thank you for those questions, Mr. Co-Chair. Anything else before we move on?
All right. Thank you, Ms. Parker. Okay, I'm trying to remember where we were now. Again, I think the decision that we made here around the ACH processing was to take a transformative approach where we now have data, personally identifiable data and information that flows through our four walls, if you will. We're entering into an agreement with our current Treasury Management Services provider because they are our current originating depository financial institution to offer us a service that they offer to thousands of their other customers around ACH that skips us as the middleman. This is not a development project. Instead, we simply won't redevelop, if you will, and fix our internal systems. We will turn them off as it relates to receiving the information through us. And the bank will turn on this service that they deliver every day to thousands of their commercial customers. And essentially, again, it's a service that they're not customizing it at all. It is simply turning it on. We're putting our account structure into the service, and that is all that we are doing.
So just to be clear, yes. Make sure I understand, if I'm looking at your diagrams correctly and understanding what you just told me, essentially we're trying to minimize data breach likelihood by minimizing the number of times that personal identifiable information is transferred. So we're trying to improve security of personal information, personally identifiable information, and those who do business with the state, both commercial and individuals. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. It's been a concern of this committee, so I want to be sure that we are all understanding that you all understand that as an issue as well. Thank you.
With respect to where we are with the project, we're actively engaged in planning for onboarding of agencies to the new service and, as I mentioned, decommissioning all of our internal services. We're in the midst of both service level and pricing negotiation with respect to our vendor.
I'm sorry, Ms. Parker. Senator Johnson.
You said pricing with respect to your vendor. Are you going to be charging state agencies for this service as well?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, we will flow through those costs in the very same way that we do today. Okay. It is not, just to follow up, it is not a one-for-one flow through. There's a very complex set of calculations because we obviously have our own staffing and other components related to our pricing to agencies as well. But it certainly is a transaction cost that is flowed through to our state agencies.
Same with cities and counties, if you're doing cash management for any of them?
So with respect to the local government investment pool, it is a very similar flow through, a very similar set of calculations. We will pass on those costs, yes.
Okay. I guess the reason that you see some of us a little jumpy about that is that I've sat in the same room and had DAS say, yeah, we're going to pass on those costs. And then came the cost, and it's like having a house dropped on you.
Sure.
And I'm just trying to figure out what kind of advanced warning. Are they so exorbitant in their increase that it's going to require a sort of prophylactic negotiation with your partners? Give me a sense of scope.
So, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, just to give you a sense of scope for the current biennium, our intent is not to change our price list rate structure for agencies or the cost that we'll charge local governments during the next biennium. If something were to change related to that, we would come back in a future legislative session and approach that. But we believe that based on reconfiguring how we work the calculation internally, that we will not have a sizable increase during the current biennium at all. And frankly, we'll be able to minimize it in the 17-19 biennium.
Thank you.
So just to be clear, incredible disappearing slides. You said minimize the increase, but at the bottom it says eventual decrease in related internal costs and long-term cost avoidance. Help me parse through that difference.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. So again, if we would have kept our current approach, so this is having to redevelop our system so that we could not only keep up with the security issues, but with the proliferation of ongoing regulatory changes, technology advances in the banking field, for us to be able to have recreated our systems internally to be able to be on that edge and keep up with that pace, the cost, and this is the cost you talked about being very difficult to quantify, but the cost would have been well in advance of what we will now pay just a minor charge for on a service-structured approach with an outside vendor.
Okay, thank you.
So when you get the apples-to-apples comparison, this approach is significantly less than what our Apple would have cost, if you would. If you compare it to what we're doing today, it certainly is an increase, but that's because we are inadequately protecting this information today. We can't keep up with technology changes. You know, so we don't have the – it's not an apples-to-apples comparison.
But in order – so in essence, what you're saying is that in order to provide the level of service and security that you will be getting with this outside service, there would be a much more significant cost increase, you think, to state agencies compared to what it will cost them to achieve that level of service and security with this mechanism.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you for saying it much more artfully than I did.
Thank you. Okay, good. I just want to make sure I'm parsing through.
You are.
Okay, good.
So moving on to the local government investment project, again, it's very similar. It's a different service set. We're not providing those direct banking services. This is a local government investment pool, and so we really are talking about transactions from the local government financial institutions into the state treasury and then back out. But those flow primarily through wire or ACH services as well, so it really impacts very many of the services that the other project does as well. The recommendation in the business case that was completed in August of 2014 was exactly the same, to use a transform approach. The reasons, as outlined here, are all very similar. The project itself is generally at the same phase, but it's planned for later implementation. In part, that's because of the capacity to implement multiple projects at the same time. But it's in part because the solution, again, also while a service hosted by our banking partner, it requires some configuration and customization before being implemented. And I'll give you an example. So the underlying system or set of services that we're providing has been in place for 25 years with the vendor, so it's a long-term proven service. But enhancement and development needs related to our specific use are necessary. So, for example, the corporate users that are typically using this are all one big happy family, and they're concentrating funds from, you know, sort of regional or local elements of the corporation into the parent portion of the corporation. While from a transaction path perspective, that works for the local government investment pool, we have to account for being separate legal entities. It's not a parent and child relationship. We don't have a true parent relationship with the local government. So transactionally, it works perfect for us, but we need to make sure that there really is some customization, really, they don't even call it customization, but some enhancements within the system to be able to deal with that slight uniqueness compared to how it's being used in the corporate world. A Again, like the ACH project, we're actively engaged in planning for implementation, including those functional requirements for the system enhancements that I mentioned. Our goal is early 2016 implementation, and as we continue negotiations with our vendors, a more specific implementation timeline will be developed. Again, we're in the midst of both service level and pricing negotiation with our vendor. Implementation costs here will be slightly greater because we're both moving to an online delivery of services and because those user-specific functional requirements that I mentioned earlier differ. And in addition to the one-time costs, like the ACH for state agencies, there will be an ongoing increase in costs from the bank that flow through to state agencies. But again, our costs internally will both directly decrease at some point as we turn off servers, et cetera, and also as if you talk about that apples-to-apples comparison, that cost avoidance piece as well. The final project that's touched by this.
Could we go back just a second? On that, the LGIP, what entity will have the ultimate fiduciary responsibility for that investment fund? And is when you're saying you're not going to be like the parent and child, will the other contracted entity have the fiduciary responsibility? Will the Treasury, I mean, how's it going to?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think we'll all share a different levels of responsibility. From an investment perspective, we will still continue to have a fiduciary responsibility. The bank, the underlying vendor for this sort of banking operational support, will have a functional or organizational responsibility that will enter into service level agreements with them with regard to. Is that responsive?
I think so. So it's essentially, the state treasury will maintain their fiduciary responsibility, the ultimate fiduciary responsibility.
Absolutely. Okay. From the investment perspective, we absolutely will continue to have fiduciary responsibility. So again, the third aspect of this policy package is for our core banking systems. That's that demand deposit account system that you saw at the center of the picture that I showed you. These were the systems that were in gray. Generally, they track individual account activity and balances. And again, remember, that was a vendor-delivered solution with a variety of custom-developed and vendor-provided solutions that operate around it. We'll initiate the business case for this during the 2015-17 biennium. Again, a variety of alternatives will be considered, but we expect that a hybrid solution is probably likely here as well due to the unique nature of the state of Oregon's needs. Again, we act as a bank, but we must interact with administrative and accounting requirements for DAS and other state agencies. That's a requirement that's not necessarily true for most in a commercial banking role. For example, your bank doesn't necessarily care how you tackle your own personal or any commercial accounting needs that you have. They give you the banking services that they give you, and you figure out how to connect that from an accounting perspective with the state. That's unique. We are all one big happy family, and we do have to make sure that that works together. We'll continue ongoing mitigation activities during the upcoming biennium. Again, that's to deal with retirements, vendor support issues, technical language code issues, and any request for resources relative to actual implementation would come to you either in a separate legislative session request or an emergency board, depending on the timing, and at your pleasure.
So just to be clear, you were very clear earlier about the fact that you've been using a QA process with some of your other projects, and I'm sure this committee can assume you'll be doing the same with this one, an analogous process to ensure that the stage gate process that's been set up through DAS and LFO will be followed for any kind of IT project.
Madam Chair, we absolutely will use a QA and QC process. We haven't necessarily worked through the DAS stage gate process because we're not subject to the same requirements. However, we have attempted to at every level meet those requirements. We've worked very closely with Mr. Cummings in your office and others to keep folks up to date as much as possible. I think we send the monthly project management summary reports at least to Mr. Cummings. I can't assure you that Mr. Borden receives them.
Okay.
So.
All right. I think you guys have a track record of doing this right, and it's great that you're doing that, and I don't have a problem per se with you not going through the DAS process in and of itself, as long as you're following an analogous and roughly equivalent process to ensure that that you end up getting all the bang for your buck, and we get the bang for our buck that we deserve, and that we have a successful project. We want to set all of these things up for success. We want to have the external checks available to make sure that things proceed just as smoothly for all these things. So,
Madam Chair, I share that desire, and certainly we are doing that. In fact, my co-sponsor, who is the Chief Information Officer for the State Treasurer's Office, and I have both at any place along the way where we have a sort of choice to follow a DAS approach or to take approach that differs, we make sure that we very carefully scrutinize if we're going to do something different, that there's a really valid and a reason that really drives us to doing something different. And frankly, we haven't often made that choice. In almost every case we've chosen, in fact, we even use the DAS business case template. I mean, down to even minor choices, we've followed that path.
That's helpful. I mean, it's just good to start to, I understand that you're not subject to that authority, but I do think that the more consistency we have about how projects like this are tackled, the less likely we are to run into challenges down the road. And end up frustrated and anxious about IT projects.
Madam Chair,
our desire is to have them succeed swimmingly and be unnewsworthy. I'm all about unnewsworthy IT projects.
I share that
Unfortunately,
position.
Our colleagues in the media are disinclined to report on good news and only inclined to report on bad news sometimes.
So speaking to some of the questions that came up earlier, and actually when we presented before the IT sub of this Ways and Means body, we actually presented this first. This just shows the phases number one and two that we presented before this committee last session with a broad overview of our intent around these projects. The areas in green are those actions and milestones that are largely completed for both the ACH and the local government investment pool projects. The areas in blue are those that are yet to come. You see that we're solidly sitting right at request budget authority, and then the actual implementation of the solutions comes next. And you'll see the overlap between the projects. We will still be very much in an implementation phase for both of the current projects as we move into an initiation stage for the core banking services project. And we're happy to report that while this was a very broad overview that we gave you last session, we are still largely on track with respect to what that broad overview was. So, what will you actually be asked to approve in replacement for the $1 placeholder? Again, dividing by the three sections. For the ACH Business Systems Renewal Project, $200,000 for implementation. That includes QA, QC costs related to the project. Those are all one-time costs. We have an estimate of $750,000 for ongoing biennial costs. Again, this is just an estimate of the cost to be paid to Treasury to the bank related to agency's statewide use of this new service. The final amount will certainly also be dependent on volume, which is ever-changing. It makes it difficult for us to look at that apples-to-apples comparison. The LGIP Business Systems Renewal Project, up to $2.2 million for implementation. Again, that's QA, QC, and that's those development costs that I mentioned related to transitioning the existing commercial system into something that works more closely for our local government system. I say up to because this is the total cost that the vendor has relayed to us it will take for them to make the changes to the system. However, it's expected to be substantially less to Treasury in the end due to potential cost sharing with the vendor, as they believe that they'll actually be able to have some reusability around those enhancements and configurations, and would share via a capital expenditure process internally many of those costs with us. So we've put the full amount into our budget request. We expect the amount we will actually have to expend to be significantly less.
Senator Johnson.
Forgive me if I'm about to ask a cynical question. This sharing with the vendor, does the vendor end up with a product then that we're paying to develop that they're going to market someplace else?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, again, this is a platform that they deliver to a number of commercial customers right now. The changes that we would make to it right now would change it so that it would open up the types of new customers they could also share that platform with. So that's exactly why they're willing to share the cost of development with us, because they do have a reusability and they will be able to market, again, not our actual platform, but some of the base changes that they need to make the platform work for us.
Follow up.
Sure.
The reason I'm so curious about this is that ODOT has a program going right now called the Road Usage Charge Program. And we, Oregon, are developing all of the computer technology. And it is very unclear to me how that is going to be sold to other states. And I use the word sold in its broadest application. It seems that the full financial burden is on Oregon. Vendors may or may not be party to administering the program. It's been very opaque how this all works, other than I know that a pilot project with a fiscal of 2.2 is now ballooned up. And it's this kind of murky relationship with vendors that is worrisome to me. And forgive me for asking, as I said, a cynical question, but the lack of transparency in what ODOT is doing with their vendors causes me to question these relationships where vendors are developing projects on Oregon's nickel and we find them then marketed in other places.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, it may be cynical, but it's the very same cynical question that I've asked of our vendor, so I think it's fair. It is different from the relationship you just described in that we are not, as a state, footing the bill to develop a new system. Again, this is a longstanding 25-year-old platform that's being deployed to a number of commercial customers. For us to use it, it will have to be changed in some minor ways for us to be able to enjoy it. Because those ways look to be reusable for other customers, the bank will be able to use it. Again, it's not the branding components. It's not, I mean, I want you to understand, it's not those pieces. It's very functional requirements that change some of the control structure. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm keep going. I was just gonna make an analogy in my 101 level once you're done with your statement to see if I'm understanding what you're saying to me.
So again, I think I've said the very same thing. As you make these changes, it sounds to us, dear vendor, like you'll be able to take, like you're also excited about these changes because you'll be able to take them and use them elsewhere. They have acknowledged that is the truth, and that is exactly why they are pursuing internally the ability for them to cost share with us. However, if they weren't able to do that, if we needed to procure this from somewhere else, the bottom line is we need the service, so we do need to pay to make, whether it's with this vendor and this set of changes or it's developing something with another vendor and somewhere else, we have to move from our current structure. There's going to be a cost attached to it.
Before you do your analogy, Madam Chair, who's reviewing this kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge arrangement with the vendor in terms of legal sufficiency?
Madam Chair, it's not a wink, wink, nudge, nudge relationship. It is very much a discrete part of the project. Our QA.
Okay, if it's good enough to agree to, it's good enough to write down. Who is the scrivener and what legal review is the scriving I'm being subjected to.
So our AG will definitely be the one who's looking at the ultimate contract when it comes into play. Our QAQC is looking at the project from that project oversight perspective. Obviously, Nancy and I, as co-sponsors, are looking at it from, again, that sort of fiduciary and management responsibility perspective. Is that responsive? I'm not sure that I'm hitting the actual issue that you
I heard the words. I don't know what they mean. I think so many of us that had to stand before rooms full of infuriated Oregonians explaining why it is that we got hoodwinked so badly on the cover Oregon just have our sensitivity meter turned way up, especially for these kind of relationships where the vendor comes away with something that may be marketed someplace else. It's all fine and dandy going in. When you're standing in front of a court litigating it later because somebody didn't dot their I's and cross their T's, it's a whole different deal. And I guess I'm just reflecting that.
So I just want to make sure, I mean, I'm just going to give a really simple analogy, and if I'm off base, help me understand this. Lots of builders build homes off of standard models, right? And they have, like, you go to a home builder and say, I want your model A or your model B or whatever. Often they'll give an opportunity for customization with finishes or whatever. But say that there's a model A that you like, but you've got somebody in your family who's in a wheelchair. So you need modifications and structural modifications, not just like grab bars and stuff that are different. And the home builder recognizes they really don't have a home or a way of doing that home that's good for people with disability issues, right? So it's going to cost them something to redo the plans. And you're going to get a benefit from that, and they're going to get a benefit from that because they're going to have it. And they say, well, it would have cost us $25,000 to redo this model based on the specs that you need and to meet all the things that you need to make this house work for you. But we're going to get some benefits, so we're only going to charge you $12,500. And then down the road, we'll be able to use it. Is that a fair analogy?
Madam Chair, once again, you have succinctly and artfully described what I struggled with to get to the committee. But yes, I think that hits the nail on the head.
Okay.
The benefit to them is that they can, again, sell it to others. In your analogy, they have a disability. They've got something on the table instead of having to start from scratch. But again, we certainly have the benefit as well.
And then that agreement, like any other contract that one develops with a home builder, would be subject to a written contract that one would hope that the individual and the company attorneys would be looking at to make sure that everybody was copacetic and that everybody had the same understanding and the contract was protecting both parties. In this case, obviously, as the legislature, we're more concerned with protecting you than with the software developers or protecting us as a state. But I just want to make sure that, I mean, I think that, I don't want to speak for you, Senator Johnson, but I think that is at the root of the question. What I heard is the root of the question that Senator Johnson was asking is, you know, this agreement is going to be subject to a contract, and the terms of what you're going to pay, what you're going to get, and what the software developer is going to be able to do with it afterwards is going to be crystal clear and is going to be reviewed by AGs for the state of Oregon on behalf of the taxpayers of the state of Oregon.
Madam Co-Chair, yes.
Thank you. Okay.
So I think I'm going to move to the core banking systems renewal component. Again, we're just kicking off this project during the 15-17 biennium. So $150,000 for business case development. Again, that includes the QAQC and some minor business case development work. And then $310,000 for what we're terming mitigating activities. That includes some consultant support related to our retirement and the host of other related issues that I talked about in the aforementioned pages. And we've got a spreadsheet that we've shared with legislative fiscal staff related to that, and I believe we're having a follow-up meeting with them on Wednesday to go into some more detail on what those mitigating activities would be as well. So one of those is really project-related. It's the business case development and kickoff. The other is really recognizing that until we get into that project stage, that we've got a set of systems that have all of the challenges and risks that I talked to you about, that we have staff that that are retiring, and that we still need to support these and sort of keep the lights on, if you will. And so we need to take a mitigating approach as we move forward.
Okay. I'm going to do a time check for a minute here, because we haven't even started Package 101, which I think in many ways is one of the more complex and important packages. Not that these aren't important.
This is my last slide, if
okay,
it helps.
But, okay, then why, this is your last slide? Okay, good. I just want to think about how to proceed. I suspect that Package 101 is going to require a certain amount more conversation, and it's you've got eight more slides for that one, 10 more slides. And I'm just trying to think about how best to handle it. I don't want to rush through it in 12 minutes. I think that would be foolhardy. It's already 13 minutes. I'm happy to get started today. I feel badly because Mr. Treasurer, Mr. Bond, others, we've had you in and out and in and out 1,200 times this session. On the other hand, I think we'd all agree that this has been a robust and thoughtful conversation, and I think Package 101 deserves an equally robust and thoughtful conversation. Mr. Borden tells me that we don't have anything on the schedule for Thursday. That's short notice, and I don't know who on your team is available, Mr. Wheeler, for Thursday. If you think that the relevant people can make themselves available on Thursday in this time block, then perhaps we ought to postpone the conversation about Package 101 entirely till that date, so we don't start and then have to disrupt. If that doesn't work for you, then I would leave it to your discretion about whether you want to have a beginning of a conversation today and then another conversation later. Thursday?
We're good.
Thursday. Okay. Then with the committee's indulgence, some of you, I apologize, may have been planning for not meeting on Thursday. We will be meeting on Thursday and hearing about Package 101, because I think that way we can give this important topic the attention it deserves. Does that seem reasonable to folks? Mr. Co-Chair, are you good with that plan?
Sure. I think you'll need to chair.
I'll chair.
I'm gone that day.
I'll chair. It's copacetic. I'll be here. All right. Then I think at this point we'll say thank you very much for today so that we don't start and then get disrupted. And I, Mr. Bond, oh, is there one more slide? I apologize.
I wanted to go through, in the brief time we have left, we could go through, I believe, slide 25, which is the KPM.
Yes. Let's do that. Let's exactly do that. Thank you very much. That would be very helpful. Very good suggestion, Mr. Bond. Thank you.
He has a board meeting on Thursday, so
perfect.
That would be great.
That, thank you. I appreciate your attention to that, Mr. Bond. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the 529 College Savings Network. We do want to change our KPM. Oh, sorry.
25. 25, I think.
Oh, 25.
Keep going.
25?
Right there.
Excellent.
We do want to change our KPM because we feel that it's actually more important for us to measure and more important for you to look at how we're doing if we can we can show how many kids in this state have a 529 plan in their name. The current KPM looks at how many people, how many account owners there are having an account, but it doesn't actually show how many kids in each county. So, for example, you give a grandparent that has an open account that lives in California, but the kid lives here, and so we would want to count that child. In our current, we wouldn't count that child because the Californian has the opened account, so they wouldn't be an Oregonian. So in this case, it really helps us to track how we're doing in each county. It really helps us track how many kids are benefiting from this program, and I think long-term it's going to help you actually identify ways that we're doing things well and maybe things that we're not doing well that you'd want us to look at. So that KPM change would be eligible for the next biennium.
Thank you. I have one question about that, and I can't, we may have talked about this, and if we did, and I apologize for forgetting. The numbers that you're proposing for the percentages for that KPM, how do those compare to other states that have 529 plans?
So, Madam Chair, right now, when we look at other states, about a 10% participation rate, or I guess saturation rate for kids in the state, is about what other states are achieving. We're just under that, but again, that's a statewide number. Some counties are over, some counties are under. So when we look at other states, we're actually right in line with what other states are doing at that 10% number.
And if I understand your graph correctly, you're proposing that we increase the expectation by 2% a year?
Basically, we're trying to double the current participation rate in each county. That is our stretch goal. That is correct.
Okay. And all right. Other questions about this for Mr. Parker? Senator Johnson.
What makes you optimistic that that's a realistic goal?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, as you recall, we actually hired an outreach director here the last e-board, and we're really revising how we get out to more folks. We're actually doing more boots on the ground, more talking with parents. We obviously will always do a mass media campaign, but we really have adjusted our marketing and distribution to really getting out in the communities more than we ever have in the past. So we feel like if we're actually out talking with parents and working with them more instead of just putting a message across the TV, we will be more successful.
I'd like to just build a record. Mr. Parker and I have had a pretty animated conversation about this. My view is that it makes less sense to go to the High Desert Museum and meet with parents than it does to go to some of the inner city schools in Portland. And I don't know whether or not you have changed that emphasis. I'm making the assumption that some folks are well aware of the plan, some have no knowledge of it at all. And I'm just trying to correlate your marketing plan to this very aspirational increase in participation.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, thank you for the question. Actually, we are planning on hitting all of those elementary schools in and around the state. We have a new program that we're implementing this next school year. Called Be College Ready, and it really is working with schools and parent groups within those communities. So while we still may do the High Desert Museum, which is kind of a one-off everything every year.
Make no mistake, I'm not dissing the High Desert Museum.
But we still may do that, but we're actually implementing a program that actually gets us in and talking with parents in those communities, in those elementary schools. So that has been a focus of ours, which is, to the co-chair's point, which is why we think we can potentially increase the participation rate in this, because this new program gets us into those communities.
Do you anticipate any competitive tension between you, the treasurer's office, out trying to recruit families into the 529 college savings, and the retirement program, assuming that it passes?
Madam Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I don't see any, because I think both are hugely important. I think families need to plan for both of those situations. If that bill does pass, we will certainly work with the Treasurer's Office to make sure that we can coordinate our messages. But I think both of those are hugely important financial goals. And I'm just wondering
how much disposable income you think struggling Oregonians, particularly in rural places, have.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, that is always a concern of ours, which is always making sure we lower down the cost to get into these programs. I actually testified to a committee recently that we're not looking to have you stuff a ton of money in here if you can't afford it, but the statistics do show that kids with an account of $500 or less are actually four times more likely to go to college. So we're really this message about you don't have to have $80,000 in these plans. Have one in your name, in your kid's name. Friends and family can contribute to it as well, and then that kid thinks, okay, college is important to my parents, it's going to be important to me. That's been our message.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I know the senator's not dishing the High Desert Museum because I've seen her family name on the wall at the High Desert Museum. I guess I have a 101 question. It's not necessarily a Ways and Means question. It's about the College Savings Network itself. Are parents penalized when it comes time for financial aid if they've accumulated significant assets in the 529 College Savings Network towards traditional financial aid?
Mr. Co-Chair, well, I'm not a financial aid expert. The answer is penalized no. The college savings account is an asset to you as a parent, but because the federal government considers a parent asset, the calculation when you do your financial aid is only at 5.6% of that asset. If it was a student's asset, it'd be upwards of 20 to maybe 50% in the calculation. So that while the answer is not a penalty, it is an asset to you that goes into the calculation. I will say for those folks who filled out a FAFSA for your kids or grandkids, most financial aid is based on current income. They look at your assets at a much smaller level.
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, and I apologize for coming in late on your question. Centering on Senator Johnson's question about competition potentially about the college savings plan and the retirement security bill should that pass,
In the short term, there is no question that families have a fixed amount of income and they have to allocate between the various options that are available to them. I think we have to leave it to the good judgment of those families to decide whether their retirement or college education, you know, they get to decide how to allocate those resources. I would make the argument long term, the passage of the Retirement Security Bill actually enhances the college savings plan for the simple reason that the half of Oregonians who are effectively not saving for their retirement today are not going to be able to participate in the economy in any substantial means post-retirement. So if we pass a bill that achieves its goal, meaning people are able to save their resources, if they're able to voluntarily as participants in the plan for their retirement, presumably longer term, what that means is more people who are actively participating in the economy, and that includes not only participating in a program like this, but presumably participating in other aspects of the economy as well. That's just my hypothesis.
So I have a follow-up question.
Sure, and then Senator Johnson.
And I guess it's, again, a 101 question. Thank you for indulging me on this.
Sure.
So parents who invest in the 529 college savings plan, if their youth choose to go out of state, can these dollars be used to fund out of state education?
Mr. Co-Chair, absolutely. The state of Oregon offers this benefit to people that live here, but when the kids get ready to go to school, they can use it pretty much anywhere they want. Again, two-year schools, four-year schools, technical schools, graduate schools, and in many schools abroad. So it is a benefit that the legislature provides to the citizens here, but the kids can use it anywhere they want.
One last question, then I'll let this go. So can a family... Tell me the largest contribution a family can make on an annual basis to the savings plan.
Mr. Co-Chair, right now the largest contribution you can make in our plan is $310,000 per beneficiary. How the program works is that's the
family wanted to write a $20,000 check and they have the financial means to do it, they could do that?
Certainly could.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Treasurer, I'm glad I gave you an opportunity to lobby for a bill I have deep reservations about, but that wasn't my point.
I enjoyed it.
I knew you would. I want to make sure that I understood what you just said in response to the co-chair's question, because he asked a really important question. You want to put more emphasis on the children having, or young people having, the program in their name, the account in their name, and yet when the final calculation is made, if that's deemed an asset of the child, it redounds to the detriment of the child. How's that working out?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I misspoke. In their name, I meant being a beneficiary of an account. It's always going to be the parent's asset. So when it comes time for financial aid, it's never going to be the child's asset. That's by federal law. So I used the wrong term. What we're striving for is to have to track our beneficiaries, the kids who in Oregon are going to use the program.
And I would just follow up by saying I'm associated with an organization that used to make student loans, and we actually made a grant to a young man about to attend Cornell, and Cornell withdrew a like amount of institutional aid. And so the student ended up still out and unable to attend. And I don't know what you have in place to ensure that that does not occur here, but we actually had it happen, and it was incredibly disappointing. I'm pleased to say that my mother, God rest her, rectified that with Cornell, but it did happen.
Good for her.
The one other point that I would make, in addition to the fact that we've been having, Mr. Parker, you and Mr. Valley and I have been having some thoughtful, I think, conversations about other ways, including having family physicians and OBGYNs talk with patients when women are pregnant about this thing, because the sooner you get them involved, the better. But the other point that I would make is that we all know that the sooner you start one of these, the better. And so right now, having it as the percentage of people under 25 who have one of these accounts for which they are the beneficiary, I think I got my prepositions right there, is a good one. Ultimately, I'd be very interested in seeing an age breakdown on that, because I think that I'd be very interested to think about the 0 to 5. Because if you're going into schools, that's great, but that only hits kids in kindergarten, at which point there's only 13 years left before they go to college. And that is extra 5 years can make a big difference in terms of, you know, the accruing of an asset to a family. So at some point, down the road, I'd like to see this broken out by age if we switch you over to this KPM, which I think is the right thing to do, personally.
Madam Co-Chair, happy to provide that breakdown. We, too, are concerned about the average age in our program, which right now is around 10. We really want to drive that down. We've been looking at some things to try to drive that average age down more, but I share that concern.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, last question.
Multiple questions. Just on the 529 program, that is, the contributions are deductible under Oregon income tax, but not federal income tax. Is that correct?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct. Yeah, you get a state tax deduction, but there's no federal deduction. The federal benefit comes on the tax-free growth. There's no federal tax on the growth of the program.
And it doesn't count toward your gift tax if you give under the...
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
For families for whom that applies.
Yeah, so there's a state income tax deduction for your contributions each year,
and the growth is deductible.
The growth is state and federally tax-free.
Okay. And then what is your maximum? I wasn't listening closely enough when Chair Smith was asking, is there a maximum annual contribution?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, there's really no annual maximum. The maximum account balance that a child can have in his name is $310,000. So once their aggregate total of all their accounts in their name reaches 310, no one else could contribute until it falls below 310 again. It can grow above 310, and we certainly hope it does for those folks who are putting that much money in. But there's no maximum. It's just that that's the account balance and no more contributions after that account balance is reached until it lowers below.
Thank you.
So no more contributions, but if it grows because it's being invested, that's copacetic.
Yes, that's fine. We will hope that it does that.
Okay. Excellent. We good? Mm-hmm. All right. I am closing the public hearing on... Am I closing it or am I carrying it over? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5041, and I'm adjourning for the day. Thank you. Tomorrow, just by the way, Kylie, I'm adjourning for the day. Thank you. Tomorrow, just by the way...